Welcome to Season 3 of the UK Virtual School Podcast with your host, Sid, educational disruptor and founder of the first online school that dares to be different. Our third season marks the end of the third academic year, where we interview parents, students and teachers who are part of the UK Virtual School family. If you are new to our podcast, please do check out the golden gems from seasons 1 and 2. Now, this podcast is for homeschoolers, home educators, world schoolers, and those parents seeking for an alternative that is effective, flexible, and high quality. If this sounds like you, why not join us in disrupting education as we know it and creating a legacy of learning that's full of passion and enthusiasm. Welcome to the UK Virtual School Podcast. Welcome to another UK Virtual School Podcast, from the Big Bang to the physics in the classroom, the real truth about physics. So as you can imagine, today's going to be all about physics right from the beginning of time. And I've got our amazing physics teacher with us, Andrea, who joined us earlier this year. And she is going to be talking about all things physics. So Andrea, welcome. Do you want to introduce yourself and tell us a little bit about you?
I'm Andrea. I've been teaching physics for a long time, about 20 years. I teach in Wales. That's where I started my career, and I'm still living in Wales, but I'm not teaching in a mainstream school anymore. I'm teaching with the UK Virtual School. I studied physics at University of Manchester Institute of Science and Technology, which was an amazing school to learn at. The very dedicated physics team. They do lots of exciting stuff there. So it was a really good place to learn about, to be able to ask questions and go in the direction that I wanted to go in. I love being able to pass on what I've learned and my enthusiasm for physics to students.
Which physics degree did you do? Was it just a straight physics, or was it a specific area of physics?
It was physics with optoelectronics, because I was really interested in the using light photons instead of electrons for various things. But I sort of diversified from that, and I ended up doing some stuff with lasers in my third year, which was really cool, and semiconductors, basically, in the end, I drifted into. And I ended studying a master's in semiconductors, very large-scale integrated circuits. Well, it sounds about what it is. It's really interesting if you're interested in what electrons do in very, very specific situations. It's not that interesting otherwise, but what comes out of it is interesting, because it's about making silicon chips and they control everything. So yeah, it's the very, very sort of minute details of what's going on inside every bit of tech in the world, basically, which is good to know.
Yeah, it's all the cutting edge technology that we're currently using. So you were involved in the research around it, which is quite exciting.
Yeah, I did. I worked briefly for Philips Semiconductors when they had a factory in the UK. That's the sort of semiconductor industry has closed down a little bit now. I think there might be still a few labs around, but they're mostly in Europe. But that was fun, because that was everything under one roof. So from the research and development guys and the marketing people and the proper boffins who come up with the new tech and the factory, you know, you're going to have lunch with the guys who just move stuff around in the factory, and then you go and have a meeting with one of the directors who's come over from Holland. So it was, yeah, that was an interesting place to work. That was good.
Did it allow you to travel around a lot?
Not really. At that time, I had small children, so it wasn't, I moved on quite quickly from that to teaching, because it fits in quite a lot better with a family.
My school physics teacher, who taught me many, many years ago, he used to do research around semiconductors as well. And I remember him telling us stories where it took him to lots of different countries. He worked in Jordan, he worked in America, he worked in places in Europe. And then he settled in the UK, where he also became a teacher. And he became a teacher a couple of years before he taught me. And then he left teaching. He retired at the same time that I left. Well, he didn't quite retire. I think he moved to a school in London for a few years and then he retired. And I'm still in touch with him and he talks about his work and research in semiconductors. So when you mentioned it, I was like, oh, it's the same sort of stuff that he did. But his work took him traveling because I think he wanted to travel more and his kids were a little bit older. So they traveled with him a lot of the time. So there's the link. And I still don't know what it is. And this is me coming from a physics degree as well, because I did theoretical physics. So we didn't do anything that involved being in the lab. I say that in the first year, they said for us, in order for us to have a physics degree, we had to do a certain amount of lab work in the first year. So we had all of these theoretical physicists sat there who hated lab work. And we were told we had to do, I think it was 6 weeks of lab work. We were sat there going, no, you push that button. No, you do it, because we didn't want to take part. And it was just really funny. And it's interesting that after 4 years of doing that I ended up doing more practical work when I started doing my science workshops. And I realized what I was missing. And I actually really enjoy doing the practical work now. And it's amazing how we evolve. We're not always static in how we feel about certain things. And I think as kids, we can sometimes get into our head, oh, I don't like this. I don't like English because I don't like poetry. Or I don't like writing. Or I don't like maths because I can't deal with numbers. But the thing is, as humans, we evolve and we get better at some things and we see things differently after 5-6 years. And we're like, oh, I actually like that. I did not like writing essays. And then I've done a qualification at university a few years back during COVID. I did it at Cambridge and I realized I love writing essays now because I know how to do them now. And some things like clicked. But back when I was at school, I could not write an essay.
I think some of it's to do with maturity, isn't it? Just that there are, and mindset as well. If you've convinced yourself that you can't write an essay, then it's really hard to overcome that because it's in your head, isn't it? It's in there saying you can't do this. But then when you get older, and as a teacher, you're trying to give that to our kids, aren't we? To show them that they can do anything if they try. And if they try and they fail, it doesn't matter. And then it kind of eventually soaks into you and you can try things. And then you find that you're pretty good in the end. So it is interesting how you grow. We're learning all the time, aren't we? Really? When I was planning a very short break in Portugal, so I thought I'll try and learn a few phrases of Portuguese. And I'm absolutely loving it. So that's my plan for the summer. I'm going to try and get relatively proficient in Portuguese for no reason apart from the fact that I'm enjoying learning it. So I think that's what our brains are wired, aren't they? To try and to find out, to learn, to improve. We just have to sort of unlock it somehow.
Did you know from a young age that you were interested in science and physics in particular? At what point did you realise that?
I think it was probably secondary school. I went to a really, really good secondary school in the outskirts of Manchester in Trafford, where they've still got the 11 plus system. So I went to a grammar school, and because it was an all girls school, we all had to do science, whereas the school my sister went to, which was a secondary modern, I don't think she even had a physics lesson. They just did general science. But because it was an all-girls school and there was none of this sort of boys do physics, girls do biology stuff, we were all in the class together and I really, really enjoyed it. I had a fabulous teacher, wonderful, wonderful teacher called Mrs. Moss, who just was so patient and she put up with so many ridiculous questions. And, you know, she would stay after the lesson and when I'd be putting my hand up to ask something and she'd be just like, just wait till the end. And then I'd go at the end and she'd happily give up half a lunchtime to answer what I thought were very, very important questions, which she'd probably heard hundreds of times before. But yeah, so it was probably sort of about halfway through high school. Before that, I think I was convinced I was going to be a nurse or a doctor or something along those lines. So vaguely sciencey. I just found that I always wanted to know why. So that's why I love physics over chemistry and biology, even, although they're both fascinating. I like to know. I want to know about the nuts and bolts. I don't just want to know if you put this with this, it changes colour. I want to know what's going on at the lowest level and why is it that colour and where did it come from and how does that colour get into our brains? I just want to know everything, basically. So I think physics, it's the best path to that, I think. I know that maths is really the language of the universe and that everything can be brought down to mathematics, but that's a step too far for me. That's too abstract. But yeah, I want to know what the electrons are doing. I want to know what the photons are doing and the quanta and all the rest.
Yeah, while you were saying that, I was just thinking about how we would describe biology and chemistry. If physics is why, then you could say biology is what, because biology just tells you what's happening, and chemistry is how, because they're talking about the chemicals that are, like, something's happening because of, and then if you want to know, like, if you're thinking about the eye, like, what's happening is biology. We've got light entering our eyes and we see. how does it happen? Is there a chemical process that's happening? Yeah, there's signals being sent to our brain, right? And then why? That's the physics. Like, there's refractive index of your lens, and then you've got the retina at the back, and what's happening with the rods and cones. Like, that is the physics bit. It's got a bit of biology in there as well, I know, but it's mostly the physics.
And then you've got the what for, and that's philosophy or something. You can bring everything in together. That's one of the topics I really like, light, and because of the way it brings everything together, and you can do sort of really interesting demonstrations with lenses and optical illusions and all sorts of things. And it's really easy for students to grasp. It's things that they experience, and, you know, when you put a straw in a glass and it looks like it's bent, and there's a whole room full of people going, oh, yeah, I know, I've seen that. So, yeah, I like that. It's interesting.
And it's so fascinating that two people probably don't see the same things in the same way as well. And yet we think everyone sees the world the way we see it and perceives the world the way we perceive it. And I find that concept fascinating.
Really interesting work on language and colour. So there are some languages where they've got three or four different words for shades of blue. And so if you showed people a picture, for instance, they would be able to pick out more colours from the picture because they have the words for them than I would, because I've just got the word for blue. It's really interesting.
Language is just fascinating anyhow, like how, like, in certain languages you've got like 15, 16 different words for love, and in English you just have one. And then you think, are there certain emotions that you're limiting yourself because you just don't have the words to be able to describe what you're feeling? You just cluster it all into one, just like we're clustering colour all into one. If it's blue, it's just all blue, right? So it's just really fascinating how our perceptions of the world are so centred around the culture that we're brought up in, and the environment that we're brought up in, and the language that we adopt, and the way that we view the world, and the way that the people around us view the world. I think that's really a fascinating concept, which brings us back to the title of the podcast, From the Big Bang to Physics in the Classroom. Give us your take on what makes the Big Bang so fascinating.
It's so fascinating because this is something that happened at the start of the universe, and scientists have been able to work it out by being on Earth and looking up at the sky. The steps that they've gone through to get from what you can see in the sky to the fact that the Big Bang happened and how long ago it was, and all the rest of it, you can follow those through sort of quite simply. You know, there are many, many other layers to it that you could go into, but you can explain to somebody, you know, just see that over there. Because of that, we know that. And because of that, we surmise this. And because of that, we predict that. And then we observe this. And ta-da, we have this theory that shows how the universe started. It's huge. It's everything. I mean, apart from the fact that it's nice to look up at the stars, and it's nice to have a reason to look up at the stars, I think it's just a beautiful piece of showing how logic and observation and innovation and technology have all sort of come together to be able to provide this amazing information. I think it's wonderful. It's just one of the magical sort of pieces of discovery. People still call it the Big Bang Theory because, of course, another piece of information might come along that tweaks it, that makes us realise that there's something, you know, maybe something different happened along the way. And that's wonderful as well. I think from our little planet, in this vast, vast universe, being able to work that out about the vast universe is amazing.
And I think the second most fascinating thing is that we existed at the Big Bang, right, in some shape or form, because all the particles have come from that point or from that explosion. And I think that's really fascinating, that what we are as humans now have come from stars, which have come from that Big Bang, which, so we're all connected in some way. To think of that when the world seems so big to us, but to think that we're made out of all the same stuff and we came from the same thing, if you go back far enough, is quite amazing, right?
Oh yeah, absolutely. And I mean, the fact that we exist at all is quite fascinating. It's sort of a combination. The fact that there's this, the vast universe, and we're alive in it, and we have the intelligence to be able to work things out, but also that we have the equipment. There's no sort of survival Darwinian reason why we should be able to do those kind of calculations. It's no, it doesn't help us survive. There's no need for us to be able to look at the sky and see patterns, and because the patterns are there, we keep on looking until we see something else and we work it out. That doesn't help us survive. It's just something that's in us. Yeah, this sort of questing for answers and asking the big why questions, it's part of human nature, and it has been part of human nature for forever. And it's I just find that this whole coming together of us and our brains and our curiosity and what's out there that we can observe to be able to put that whole picture together is just all amazing.
I find it fascinating that at every point in history, we as humans feel like we've reached a standard of knowledge that is amazing for that time, right? And we're like, oh, everyone in our past didn't understand this. We understand this concept so well, and we can see this, and we can see how all this works. And then another 100 years time, people will look back at us and go, oh, they were so far behind in their knowledge. We've now reached another point where we can understand how this works. How silly were they to believe this? And like that keeps happening in history, right? But it's the fact that at any point we think we know all of these amazing things, and yet we only know this small little fraction of what there is to learn out there. From a student's perspective, there's still so much more to research and so much more to find out yet that we don't know, right? But I think sometimes we can feel like everything's been discovered and everything is known to us, but it's not. There's still things that are being discovered right now. And we're at a point now where technology is so accessible to everyone. The internet is so accessible that literally anyone can be able to teach themselves things and then go and do research and go and do things with the knowledge that's been made available. While in the past, I think that would have been only available in certain libraries across the world, and you only had access there if you were part of those libraries or part of that circle. That is really fascinating as well.
Absolutely. I mean, we wouldn't have been able to study physics even, you know, 100 years ago as women. It does feel like a sort of a special time to be alive, but you're right, in 100 years time they'll have 5-year-olds doing what we do and thinking, idiots, how did they not know this? I think possibly Richard Feynman spoke about it just being, you know, you think you know everything, but actually you're just sitting at the edge of the ocean throwing pebbles in, and there's the vast ocean out there that we still haven't discovered. You're just dropping pebbles and looking at the ripples and thinking that you know everything. I mean, that was a very, very large paraphrase, but something along those lines. And I think if someone as brilliant as Richard Feynman can think that he just knows next to nothing, then we all need to be a bit humble about what we understand, don't we?
More space has been explored than what we've explored underneath our oceans, right? Because we don't actually know what's underneath there. There's still species that are being discovered that are like so close to us, rather than going out into space, we could actually spend our entire lives just exploring the ocean and still not have explored everything down there. And that's really fascinating. There could be a whole world living down there and we're just not aware of it. Maybe mermaids do exist.
Yeah, well, that's another thing that's sort of interesting from a looking outwards point of view as well, because there are places under the sea where they've found life exists that is different to the life that we see, where there are these tiny bacteria that live off the chemicals and the heat from undersea vents, for instance, volcanic vents. And it sort of opens up the possibility that maybe out there somewhere there is another planet where it doesn't matter that there isn't oxygen, because they don't need it, because they don't respire. They get energy a different way, which is, you know, just bringing the marine biology back to physics again. That's what I like to do. But there was only, I don't think it was that long ago, but there was an expedition to somewhere in South America that they found a valley, and they found sort of quite large rodents, mammals that they'd never ever seen before. So that's on land, because there are, you know, dense jungles and things where people haven't been, or people who write things down and record things haven't been. So yeah, there is a lot out there to be discovered.
So there could be a dinosaur that's actually alive and we just don't know it. It's living somewhere and it's guarded by this big vast jungle, and then we're going to go and bring it to mainland, and then it's going to all be chaos, right?
Yeah, Jurassic Park, live. Let's hope not.
Do you think that aliens exist?
Yes. I feel statistically, probability, there must be another planet out there where life has formed. It's an infinite universe. It's like the idea of an infinite number of monkeys with an infinite number of typewriters would eventually produce the works of Shakespeare. If they can do it once, they can do it again. So if life has formed on Earth, then it sort of must have formed somewhere else. But what I don't believe is that we would ever find it, because it's an infinite universe, so, and it's expanding. There might be life out there, but it's so far away that we would never, even if we could travel across space to find it, by the time we got there, it might have disappeared, because the time in the universe is different to the way we perceive time, even geological time, compared to, you know, the life of a solar system. The growing and decaying of a mountain is nothing compared to the time it takes for the star to form and the planets to form around it. So yeah, the time scales just wouldn't work, and the distances. So yeah, I think there is life out there, but I don't think we're ever going to see it, unfortunately. I don't think they're going to turn up and, you know, beedly beedly, take me to your leader, unfortunately, because that would be quite cool.
I think it's fascinating that every, like, aliens that are designed, and you look at, like, some of the octopus that exist, and you're like, oh my God, that looks like the alien from the movies that they make, because octopuses have these big heads and the big eyes, right? And you're like, it looks like an alien life form. And maybe they're just octopuses that are existing in different places, and they're just huge and massive. Yeah, it could be another life form that we do have on Earth, but it's evolved and become a species that is very intelligent, because they've got big brains, right? They're very clever creatures, and they can shapeshift. They can go through little nooks and crannies, and yeah, they're a really fascinating species of animal.
They are. They're amazing. Absolutely amazing. Have you seen they can sort of get across land as well? If, a small distance, they can sort of come out and crawl from one pool to another, which is quite scary. That's what's coming next after the fall of the humans. The world will be taken over by octopi.
I find it really fascinating. Like, we've got air. There's some animals that just live in the air, right? They can land, but they're mostly like flying around, and they're just like in the air. And then we've got land animals, and they just live on the land. And then we've got things that live underground, right? You've got all these creepy crawlies and stuff. And it's almost like when we die, we shift from being on the land to in the land. And you're thinking there's like this cycle. I just find it really fascinating how one species that can survive in one, like either air, ground or water, can't survive in the other one. So you were talking about octopus, they can survive in the water but not on the land, but we're the reverse. We can survive on the land but not in the water, but we can for a little while in the water, right? And so maybe on their kind of octopus planet, they're just like the opposite of what we are. They just survive in the water and then come onto the land for a little while. So it's in reverse, and they create their whole empire in the water. This could be a story.
I know. It's quite good, isn't it? I like the idea of this. In a planet completely covered in water, maybe, so that they're with undersea mountains.
You could argue the Earth is covered in water. There's less land than there is water, right? I think it's 66% water, I think. So it's not far-fetched to think of a species that lives in water and then just has like bits of land which they just attempt to cross. So maybe they have to design like a fish bowl so that they can cross land in a fish bowl, like we do it in a boat, right? It's just really interesting to kind of think all these concepts, and then to realize actually our mind is limited to what we know. What about the stuff we don't know? Because we can't relate to it, right?
We always assume that they're going to arrive in some recognizable spaceship and be able to communicate in some way. But what if, they're much smaller, much bigger, communicate with light instead of sound? There's so many sort of, and that's quite limited variables. But the universe is huge, like I say, so what could exist elsewhere in the universe is unlimited.
What kind of final thoughts do you want to leave the audience? Is there some sort of big question that you have that really fascinates you about the universe?
My biggest question, and we get into philosophy, is just why do I find the stars so interesting? Why do I feel a connection to it, and other people feel a connection to music and to art and all of these things? What is the benefit of that? It just feels like it's really special that we have that connection to things that aren't to do with survival. They're just, things are beautiful or things are fascinating or, they move you in some way. You know, it would be lovely to have some kind of answer, maybe from a biologist one day who's into evolution, to explain to us, why do we find things beautiful? Why do we find things fascinating? That's my question. So it's quite a big one.
Do you think it's limited to just humans, or do you think animals also think like that?
I feel like it's just humans.
But if you watch animals, like if you really watch them, if they're in like in a safe environment, it's not just about survival. Like I think when humans are in survival mode, they don't think about these things, right? So if you think about an animal that's in a safe environment and they're happy, they've got their food, they've got everything, especially pets, you look at pets, they get so curious about little things around the living room, or like they want to explore, they want to push things, they want to touch, and there's that curiosity that you see in a toddler also exists in an animal, like a cat or a dog or a bird or whatever animal it is, right? There seems to be this innate desire to explore and touch and kind of see what something is when we go past the survival area. And I wonder whether if we didn't harm animals and they were left to their own devices, maybe in these jungles that we've talked about where we found all these big rodents, maybe they will become more civilized in a like organized manner, and they start exploring the universe like we are, right?
Yeah, maybe. Maybe it is just a part of being alive. Curiosity is just the next step. Once you've got comfort, you can go on to thinking about what's next.
It was meant to be the last question, but then it makes me wonder, who were the people who designed the Egyptian pyramids? Because they seemed a lot more civilized than us. Who were the people that designed all of these ancient civilizations, which seemed to be far more civilized than what we are, right? And what happened to them, and what wiped them out? And I think that's a whole other question, which is...
Absolutely. There's so many sort of sites around the world where there are these wonderful cities and things that are just left as they were because they were abandoned at some point. And it's a very big what happened here, isn't it?
So many exciting things to talk about. So Andrea is our physics teacher at UK Virtual School, and it's so interesting hearing things which aren't necessarily on the curriculum, just the platform to just talk about it. Maybe we need to start up like a science social club where the kids just come and ask these big questions, and we explore what happens in those areas and just see where the conversations goes. Because I think science is so fascinating for even young kids. It's a natural curiosity to keep learning and keep, like we talked about today, keep kind of finding answers. So thank you for joining me today. I think it's been great finding out a little bit more about you and exploring physics. I love having chats about physics. I think I find it really fascinating. I'm such a nerd. Thank you so much.
My pleasure. Lovely talking to you.
Thank you so much for tuning into the UK Virtual School podcast with your host, Sid. I look forward to having you join me again soon. In the meantime, if you're considering online schooling to take away the stress of having to plan and structure everything yourself, why not head over to our website, www.ukvirtualschool.com. You can join in our next online open day or book in a Zoom meeting with me to discuss options. I look forward to seeing you soon. Bye.